Welcome to this episode of Out of the Best Books, the podcast where we deep dive into classic literature and have conversations about what we've learned and discovered along the way. We love all things books and reading, and we want to share our love of the classics with you. We hope to inspire you to read along with us and join in the conversation. I'm Amity.
And I'm Laura. Let's get started. So today we're continuing our discussion of To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee. This is my first time through and I love it.
Awesome.
Like, I just want to keep reading. I try to pace myself with our books so that I, because I have to like write things up, right? But I just want to like go on to the next chapter instead of do my little outlines or whatever. But one thing I thought was interesting this week is I came across this post on Facebook, the 10 must read books of all time. And this book was number one.
I love it. It is just so good. Good in every aspect of that word. It is so well written. It has such good characters. Like, it transports you back in time in such a really a beautiful way. And there's so many good morals, so many good discussion points. It makes you want to be a better person. And it helps you to see these good people who are doing good things in a difficult time, difficult circumstances. I don't know. It's just so good. And I remember a few years ago, I think, you know, there were a lot of books that, especially some groups in our country were like saying, well, these books need to be canceled. We shouldn't be reading these books anymore. And this was one of them. Wow. To Kill a Mockingbird, because it has a quote unquote white savior, if you will. I don't think these people have read this book. I don't know how you could read it and not just like cheer for these good, good people. They're people of their time living in this very difficult, very racist, segregated time. And yet still they're able to rise above and do good and be good and love everyone. You just learn so much from Atticus Finch. He is like, he's probably one of the top characters of all time, I think.
Well, first of all, I texted my son that a screenshot of that top 10 books that everybody needs to read. And I was like, you need to read this. And he's like, well, there's just so many books on my list, you know? And I said, no, you need to read this. this is number one. But another thing that's funny is you talk about, people often will talk about a book they read and they're like, well, I just didn't really like any of the characters in the book, or like, I couldn't get behind any of the characters in this book. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I love every character in this book. Except maybe Aunt Alexandra so far.
Which I don't think you're supposed to like her. So that's fine.
But like all of them, I love Jem, I love Scout, I love Calpurnia, I love Atticus is like my goal for parenting in life.
Yeah.
Love it.
Good. And you love Miss Maudie.
Yes.
And like even, I don't know, even just some of the goofy characters around town, you're like, these are so great. What incredible skill of the author as well, which I think that this is another thing that makes a classic, is that the author is able to create these very distinct characters. Like, that is amazing. It's amazing. They have these incredible personalities that she has created. But although sometimes, and I'm sure you've heard this too, authors will talk about how they kind of learn from their characters and they are kind of discovering what their characters are going to do as they're writing. You know, it's almost like their characters do take on a life of their own as they allow them to. Like, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, they kind of don't know what they're going to do.
Yeah.
Until they're in the middle of the writing, they're like, oh, well, this character wanted to do this, or, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, they learn from that. That's interesting.
Yeah, I think so.
It's probably one of those books that people would say, like, I'm jealous of you because you are experiencing it for the first time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it totally does. It totally does. I have to agree.
So when it's over, I'm going to have to be one of those people that I'm like, I'm jealous that you're experiencing it for the first time. So good. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know how we're going to top this year, but we will. I mean, we'll keep going. It'll be good. But
I think so. And I keep looking at our list for this year. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is such, we have so many good books. In fact, I was talking to a lady the other day and she's very bookish as well. And I was just telling her about our podcast. She's like, oh, cool. And so she immediately looked it up and she saw our lineup because you had put that in the notes for the podcast. She's like, oh my gosh, these are so many great. She's like, wow, Jane Eyre, I love Anne of Green Gables. Oh my gosh, you have like my favorites. And so, yeah, I think we have a great lineup. I'm really excited.
So Jane Eyre was on that list of top 10 books everyone should read, and Pride and Prejudice, which we did last year. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And then
Look at
Lord of
that.
the Rings, which we're not going to do Lord of the Rings, but.
We are going to do The Hobbit. And I bet we'll do Lord of the Rings eventually, but you kind of, I think you have to start with The Hobbit. That sounds like an amazing list. Maybe, will you send me the screenshot too? Okay. To jump right in. Okay. So today we're covering chapters 9 through 14. We jump in to Scout. She is fighting a little boy, and we find out that he's called her dad a very crass, kind of vulgar thing. It's a word that we do not say. We do not say, but we find this throughout the book. It's something that it is so disrespectful and so awful. I can't say it. I'm sure everybody knows what it is, but he had said some things about her father. And so she was mad. So she picks a fight with him. She repeats to her father what this boy had said. And her father's like, Scout, we don't say that. She's like, well, if you don't want me to say vulgar words, don't send me to school. You know, she's like always trying to find a way to get her father to not send her to school anymore. But she is curious, like, why are these people saying this about you? And he says, well, it's because I'm defending a man named Tom Robinson. And nobody thinks that I should. And she's like, well, if nobody thinks you should, why are you doing it? I'm going to give a lot of direct quotes from Atticus because he's just incredible. He says, for a number of reasons, the main one is if I didn't, I couldn't hold up my head in town. I couldn't represent this county in the legislature. I couldn't even tell you or Jem not to do something again because he knows it's right. And it's one of those things that, like, when you know it's right, you have to do it. He has such a strong conscience. So, he's amazing. This is quite a long chapter, so I'm going to kind of fly through it. So Christmas is coming up. Jem and Scout like Christmas, but there's parts of it they don't like. The part they do like is that their uncle Jack comes to visit. So he comes there. He's a great guy. He's never married. He's a doctor, doesn't have children, but he's a pretty fun uncle, very chill. But while he's there and during the Christmas time, they go to the landing, the Finch Landing, where their Aunt Alexandra lives and their Uncle Jim. And so funny because says that their Uncle Jimmy, Scout says, he never spoke a word to me in my life except to say get off the fence once. I never saw any reason to take notice of him, and neither did Aunt Alexandra. So even his own wife, like, doesn't really care for him. It's just kind of a dud. It's kind of sad. It's really interesting because Aunt Alexandra is younger than Atticus, but she has an adult son and now a grandson who's a year older than Scout. So she has a grandson who is older than her older brother's daughter, if that makes sense. So this grandson gets shipped off to them each Christmas. His name is Francis, and he's just a piece of work. Atticus, Jem, Scout, and Uncle Jack, they go to the landing for Christmas time. The only good thing about it is that Aunt Alexandra is an excellent cook. Other than that, they kind of hate it. They kind of are always trying to find excuses to not go, but their dad is like, no, we have to go. Oh, and I do have to throw in here that for Christmas, their dad had gotten them some air rifles. They were really excited about that. And the side note, Uncle Jack was like, hey, Atticus, you got to teach him how to shoot. And Atticus is like, no, you teach him. You teach him. They head out to the landing. And while they're there, it's just kind of a nasty experience because Aunt Alexandra is always very critical of her brother and his parenting technique. She always has a lot to say about Scout and the fact that she runs around in overalls and she doesn't think that she's very ladylike. She tells her that she should be a ray of sunshine in her father's lonely life. I suggested that one could be a ray of sunshine in pants just as well, but Auntie said that one had to behave like a sunbeam, that I was born good, but had grown progressively worse every year. She hurt my feelings and set my teeth permanently on edge, but when I asked Atticus about it, he said there were already enough sunbeams in the family and to go on about my business. He didn't mind me much the way I was. I don't know. I can just relate to this so much. You've got these siblings who are very judgmental about your parenting, and you're like, these are my kids, and I'm gonna do it the way that I want to. But at the same time, you don't love like butting heads with them. So it's almost like in private, you tell your kid, no, you're just fine. Like it doesn't matter what they say. And so that's kind of what is happening here. But then also, Frances takes it upon himself to say the same thing to Scout about her father that this other boy did.
Which makes you wonder how he knew. because he doesn't live there.
No, he doesn't live there. But obviously it had been going around the family because he also says your dad is going to be the ruination of this family and you're bringing shame to everybody. Yeah, he's just very rude and demeaning. And Scout had been told by her dad, you know, there's going to be people who say mean things to you about me and you just have to ignore it. And so she'd been trying to, but she just couldn't anymore. And so she like punched this kid in the teeth, like she did.
And hurt her knuckle.
And called him a whore lady. And so her uncle comes on this. Her uncle Jack and her aunt Alexandra, they come on this. And of course, the little Francis kid is such a brat. And he's just like, she called me this and she started. And she's like, no, he totally started it. But she is the one who gets a licking. I don't know how he did it, if he did it on her butt or what. But her uncle whipped her. And that makes my blood boil. I know it was like a different time. And that kind of thing did happen a lot, even from teachers. But oh my gosh. Okay. Yeah. Couldn't do that. But the thing is, they did leave immediately. They left the landing. They went home. And Uncle Jack came to her and she was like, hey, listen, I like you, but you don't understand children. I love it. I loved it. And he actually like took a minute to listen to her. And she was like, you know, you told me to not behave this way or not to use foul words unless extreme provocation. And this was extreme provocation. And this is what Francis said about my dad. And this is what he did. And then her Uncle Jack is like really, really angry and not at her. He's like, that kid can't get away with that. That was awful, you know, and he felt really, really bad. She does say to him, she's like, please don't tell Atticus what I did or what Francis said. I don't want him to know. And so she does go, she walks past him talking to Atticus and he's like, I'm never going to have children. I'm never going to get married. I'm never going to have children because I don't have the touch basically.
Yeah. Well, Scout told him, you don't understand children. And he's like, okay, well, I'm like, not going to die.
He's like, yeah, you're right. I don't. But I thought it was really good, something that Atticus said, because it's just true. He says, when a child asks you something, and this is him talking to his brother, Jack. He says, when a child asks you something, answer him, for goodness sake. But don't make a production of it. Children are children, but they can spot an evasion quicker than adults. An evasion simply muddles them. No. And then he also says, bad language is a stage all children grow through. And it dies with time when they learn they're not attracting attention with it. So it's like the thing to not do is to make such a huge deal about it, but to just be like, all right, it's a stage. And that's how so many things are. The bigger deal we make out of it, the longer it's going to last. But if you don't make a huge deal out of it, it's like it dies out because it's not getting them anything. And they understand that it's not acceptable. And so you move on. This was a long chapter. I'm sorry. So last part of this, Jack is asking him about the case with Tom Robinson. And he's basically like, I know that I'm not going to win. He's like, it's really a he said, she said type of thing. And you really think a jury is going to rule in favor of a black man, even if we know that he's innocent? He says, you know what's going to happen as well as I do, Jack. He says, why reasonable people go stark raving mad when anything involving it comes up is something I don't pretend to understand. He's somebody who has been raised in the deep South. I think he must have left to like get his education. I can't remember. But one way or the other, he's a very good man who can see through the bull crap when so many people cannot.
So it must not have been how they were raised, because Aunt Alexandra doesn't seem to have that. Like, she doesn't seem to be as evolved as they are.
Yeah, no, not at all.
So that was one of the quotes I had pulled out when you said that when a child asks you something, answer him. And I was like, what I love about Atticus is he has this parenting theory, parenting, whatever, what he wants to do, and he does it.
Yeah.
Like, he follows through with it. Some of the sentences in this book, you're just like, oh my gosh, like, she is a writer.
A writer. Like, yeah.
I love what she said, what Scout says about Francis. Talking to Francis gave me the sensation of settling slowly to the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah, I underlined that too. Child
I've ever met.
And it's like being with him is like bringing me down too, because it's so depressing. That was really, really good.
And the other thought I had about this chapter was like, Atticus is always saying, okay, you were talking about like when somebody judges how you're parenting, and that happens often, especially like immediate family, right? Like, sometimes your parents could think you're doing something that they wouldn't have done, right? Or your siblings might have an opinion about how you're, what you're doing with your kids. But I love this. The only time I ever heard Atticus speak sharply to anyone was when I once heard him say, "Sister, I do the best I can with them." It had something to do with my going around in overalls. It's not a big deal. She's wearing overalls. I'm doing the best I can. And it's just me.
Like we've talked about before, he's very present. Obviously, you know, he has a lot of work to do and he's got a lot of responsibilities, but when he's there, he's very present with them.
Yeah, I loved it too. That's our whole podcast with this one. I loved it. I loved it. I love this chapter.
That is okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, so chapter 10, this is the chapter where we get the quote that gives us the title of the book. Because I wondered what that was about. I figured it'd come at the end. But so we learn that Atticus is older than most of the other fathers in Maycomb, which I think could be why he's like he is. But the kids are a little embarrassed by some of the things that he does because he's older. Like he wears glasses and he reads a lot. And instead of hunting and fishing and drinking and playing poker, like all the other dads, he just kind of, he doesn't participate in that stuff. You said in the last chapter, he'd given them air rifles, but he wouldn't teach them to shoot. And they knew that Atticus just wasn't interested in guns, like at all. So Atticus does say to Jem one day, "I'd rather you shot at tin cans in the backyard, but I know you'll go after birds. Shoot all the blue jays you want if you can hit them. But remember, it's a sin to kill a mockingbird." And so they kind of, I guess they don't understand why or whatever. So Miss Maudie then agrees with him and says, "Yeah, it is a sin to kill mockingbirds." And she says, "Your father's right. Mockingbirds don't do one thing but make music for us to enjoy. They don't eat up people's gardens, don't nest in corn cribs. They don't do one thing but sing their hearts out for us. That's why it's a sin to kill a mockingbird." It has to have something big to, it can't just be this quote in here. It's going to come back in
the No, there is a character who could be the mockingbird.
Mockingbird, which reminds me of like Hunger Games.
I know, the Mockingjay.
Yeah.
Totally.
I love the conversations that the kids have with Miss Maudie about what their father can do. Well, I think it might just be Scout, right? Because she's like upset that he doesn't seem to be able to do anything interesting or like exciting. And Miss Maudie says he's the best checker player in town. He makes wills so airtight that nobody can meddle with them. And he can play a Jew's harp. And then I love this too. This is great writing, which makes Scout even more ashamed of him.
I did not remember that. I just died laughing. I was like, oh my gosh.
Perfect writing. Oh my gosh.
It is. Yeah.
So I looked it up. Do you know what a Jew's harp is?
Yes. Yeah.
I did it. So I looked it up and you can watch like YouTube. You can watch videos of people playing it. Obviously you can watch anything on YouTube, but
yeah.
It's this tiny little instrument. They call it, you can call it a mouth harp or a jaw harp. And you blow into it and you strum it with your hand while you're blowing. And it kind of just makes this vibrational sound.
Yeah.
Just like not music. I didn't think of it as music when I was listening.
Yeah, it is. Not super pretty. It's kind of a, I think it's kind of a cool sound, but it's, I don't think it's very pretty no. at all. So
and Scout's like, "Can't everybody play a Jew's harp? Like, this is not so funny." So then Scout goes home and Jem is busy. He's shooting at tin cans in the backyard. She's like, "Why aren't you shooting at birds?" So she kind of goes, this is hilarious to me. She goes and spends 2 hours out on the side of the porch, what she calls making a breastworks. What they call it. And so I looked that up too. It's like well, you can tell from the text that it's like a defense. She built herself something to hide behind so she can shoot. So when Atticus comes home and he finds her crouched down, aiming at Miss Maudie's house, he asks her, "What are you aiming at?" She's like, she's aiming at Miss Maudie's rear end. The funniest thing ever.
She is such a little character. Like, oh my gosh, she's just this wild little thing. She's hilarious.
Atticus runs over to Miss Maudie's and warns her that she's in considerable peril. Then when he gets back home, he tells Scout, "Okay, break up camp." And I love how he like tells her what to do, but he's like playing along with her. Break up camp. Don't ever point that gun at people again. Then another day when the kids are out with their air rifles, they're looking for a rabbit or a squirrel. And just like they're behind, I guess, I think it says like 50 yards behind the Radley place, they see this dog coming towards them. And the dog is like, his head is tilted and he's to the side and he's looking out the corner of his eyes. This is something we don't see Yeah. So it's very interesting.
That is exactly what I was thinking. I was like, there's so many things in here that you're like, this was a very different time. It was less than 100 years ago, but good grief, it was such a different time. We don't see diseased dogs, stumbling down the street. And I don't know if it was rabies, but it probably was. But yeah, we just don't see that.
Well, it's February. So I wanted to look that up. Like, what does the time of year have anything to do with? They shouldn't have seen a mad dog in February for some
Yeah.
reason.
Isn't that interesting? It makes me wonder. I think they normally would get it from other animals, like raccoons or wolves or whatever. And in the winter, those guys are usually like hiding away.
Yeah, but they're
Something
like,
to
it's
do with
February. I know it shouldn't be a This shouldn't be an issue, but it was. The kids come home and they tell Calpurnia that they saw this dog. And that's when she's like, in February? Doesn't she go outside and look? And she's like, oh, yeah.
Yeah,
So
she knows.
she called Atticus, who comes home with Heck Tate, who's the sheriff. And Heck brings a rifle and he asks Atticus to shoot the animal. And so Atticus does it. And he hits the dog with his first shot and he's like pretty far away from the dog. And the kids see it. Miss Maudie tells Jem and Scout that when Atticus was a young man, that he was the best shot in the county. They called him One Shot Finch. And they're just like, what? This is
My dad?
so Scout is like super excited to brag about it, but Jem's like, don't say anything about it. He says, I reckon if he'd wanted us to know, he'd have told us. If he was proud of it, he'd have told us. I love the story. Like you said, it's like a slow burn, but so interesting. The writing, I think, helps. I don't know, the quality of writing helps the story
Yeah,
move.
absolutely. And I think it's really interesting some of the sort of the commentary and thought with that. Yeah, a couple of things that Miss Maudie told them about this, because I think they were like, well, why didn't you tell us this when you were listing all of his good traits and stuff, And she was like, I think maybe he put his gun down when he realized that God had given him an unfair advantage over most living things. I guess he decided he wouldn't shoot till he had to, and he had to today. That's really interesting to like be somebody who does not let your ego get in the way of your conscience, And he was really, really good at this. And most people would be like, yeah, I'm going to show off all the time. I'm going to be like this skilled hunter. Look at all these pelts on my wall, whatever. And he was like, actually, I kind of have an unfair advantage. So this is a great talent and I will use it when I need to, but otherwise I'm not going to. And something else she said that really struck me, she said, people in their right minds never take pride in their talents because those are like, they're God-given. Now, a talent will only take you so far. You have to keep developing it. And that is something that, you don't necessarily take pride in, but you can feel good about that. Like there was this thing that I'm blessed with and I've multiplied it, It reminds me of something. People in their right mind never take pride in their talents. Yeah, it's like I read this book called The Real George Washington, I believe, and it talked about his education and how something that he was taught was that when someone compliments your natural features and things, you shouldn't say thank you. You should be gracious, but you can't take credit for the shape of your eyes or your smile. You didn't do anything about that. But if they compliment your good manners or like the way that you work so hard or something like that, you say thank you because that is something that you worked out. And I think that's kind of the same thing here, is that things that we are naturally just good at, we can't just take pride in because it's something that we were blessed with. People who are naturally fast runners, or honestly, like people, you find some really big egos in the music industry, especially singing. I think people who have developed the talent in a musical instrument, there can be absolutely some natural talent there, but that still requires a ton of hard work, right? But people who are really good singers, there still needs to be some development, but so much of that is just so natural. It's like either you can really sing or you just can't. And so like the people who have huge egos there, it's like, I mean, you're kind of blessed with that.
It's true. I always thought, okay, if anybody listening is a singer, don't listen to me. But like when I went to music school at BYU, I was always jealous of the singers. And it's probably more intricate than I think, like the work to sing. But I was like, Learning songs on the piano seemed so much harder than singing a song. And I was always jealous. I'm like, not hard. But I'm probably wrong, but
Well, and like I guess I can't really speak on it too much either, because there are like the classically trained, opera singers and things. So yes, I know that there is a lot of technique and training that goes into that. A lot of the people who are like famous singers, it's a lot of natural stuff right there. Like it's
or
just
they're given, like, I just think of like pop singers, they're given, a lot of them are like given the good, they were born with good looks, which then helped them with their career or whatever. And they, I don't know, it's like,
Right. No, it's true, because there's plenty of people who have like even better voices than they do, but they just don't have like the star quality or whatever. So,
exactly.
yeah.
But yeah, for sure, there's people that sing and it was a lot of work. And oh, opera singers, I just, we just saw Les Mis, and like the singers
Ooh.
in that Broadway show were just so incredible. I was like, wow,
Yeah.
so floored.
Yeah.
It kind of makes those pop singers look ridiculous.
It kind of does. Yeah, that is where in singing the people do put in like so much work.
Yeah, we're going to see The Lion King this week.
Ooh.
And I are going to go to Portland and see it with my sister, and I'm so excited. Presley's going to love it because she's obsessed with The Lion King.
That
Anyway.
is really fun. So do you guys like have a season pass or something, or?
No, we bought the girls, so my nieces, we bought them tickets to see The Lion King, and then it got
How fun.
canceled because of the ice. And so
Oh.
they rescheduled two performances at 1 o'clock on Thursdays. And I was like,
Oh.
oh, I'm taking, and we had like priority to get seats because we had
Okay.
been to the, or we had tickets to the one that was canceled. And I was like, I'm not going to waste an opportunity to take Presley to a show like that in the day because she can't make it at 7:30 at night. Like,
Sure.
and in Portland, we would have to like
Yeah,
stay
that's
in a
so
hotel.
late. Yeah.
So I was like, I'm taking her out of school and we're going. We're
Oh,
going.
that's so fun. That's cool. I love plays. I love shows like that. They're
And
so well done.
you live in the best place.
I have to say, I agree. Like,
Absolutely.
there's some pretty awesome stuff.
When we lived in Utah, I lived in Utah when I went to college, and I, my friend and I, we went to plays like every weekend. It was just the best place
Yeah.
that year, but it was awesome.
Down the street from the Finches lives Mrs. Henry Lafayette Dubose. And Scout, to put it nicely, hates her. They don't like to walk past her house because she's this very, very old woman who just sits out on her porch and just yells at them. Whenever they walk past, she doesn't have anything nice to say. She calls Scout ugly. She just talks about how they're just these unruly children. What are they doing? What are they thinking? And now she has started saying things about their father, very similar to what Francis said, and this little boy at school, and they're just running into it all the time, saying very awful things about their father, that he's a bad person because he is defending Tom Robinson. And they've just had it. Atticus is such a gentleman. He's always gentlemanly to Mrs. DuBose, no matter what. And he tells Jem that he needs to be the same way, and Scout too. But one day she just like keeps going at it, keeps going at it. And Jem loses it. They'd been going to town and they were going to get Scout this little baton so she could practice baton twirling. And on their way back home, he couldn't take it anymore. He grabbed her baton and he went to Mrs. DuBose's garden and he chopped off the heads of all of her camellias. He just went wild. That was his little revenge act. And he goes home and his dad finds out what he did, and he's like, well, you have to go apologize, right? And Scout was actually going to go with Jem, but her father's like, no, don't go. Jem goes and he apologizes and tells Mrs. DuBose that he's going to work in her yard every Saturday to help bring the camellias back. But another agreement is actually reached. I think he's still going to help in the yard, but he has to go and read to her for like 2 hours every day. And so Atticus is like, yeah, you're going to do that. And so every day for a month was the agreement. Jem and Scout, she tags along with him, they go and they sit by her bedside and they read to her. And he starts out with Ivanhoe, which is a very long book. He's reading to her and they notice that, like, at a certain time, this alarm goes off and then they leave. And there's also like you know, she'll be pretty with it for the most part, but then she starts like making weird sounds with her mouth and doing weird things with her face, and they're not sure what's going on. An alarm will go off, and then Jessie, who is her hired girl, she will come and shoo them out, tell them to go home. So this pattern continues over time, the month, you know, continuing on and carrying on. And they start realizing that the alarm goes off later and later each day, to where they're actually staying longer than 2 hours. In fact, one day Atticus shows up. He's done with work because they're usually done like a while before he's done with work. But he's done with work and he comes in, and then the alarm goes off. So they realize that they've been staying longer and longer every day. And now it's also going for longer than a month. Finally, one day, Atticus, it's one evening, when they finally get the go-ahead to stop. It's been like a couple of weeks, I think. So they're not going to read to her anymore. And Atticus gets a phone call. He goes over to Mrs. DeBose's house. And he's gone for a little while. And he comes back. And he says, she just passed away. He's like, she was one of the bravest women I've ever known. And they're like, how could you say that? She says terrible things about you. There's this rumor that she like kept a Confederate pistol under her blankets to shoot people with. And she just seems so mean and awful all the time. And he's like, you know, she was fighting a morphine addiction. But she decided, you know, that she was going to die and not be beholden to anyone or anything. It was holding her within its grasp. And she was wildly addicted to it. And so what they realized was that every day, when they were there reading to her, it was sort of like a distraction so she could go a little longer and a little longer without the morphine. So when the alarm went off, that's, you know, she made it as long as she could that day, but it did. It kept going a little bit longer. And so they said, well, so did she die a free lady? And he said, yeah. And she suffered a lot more than she probably needed to because the morphine was taking pain away, but she did not want that to have control of her. And so, okay, there's this really wonderful quote. And I love this. And I think that we can learn so much from this. And this is one of those things when I read it, I was like, this is another reason they wanted to cancel this because nobody wants to think this way. This is what Atticus said to his kids. He said, she had her own views about things, a lot different from mine, maybe. Son, I told you that if you hadn't lost your head, I'd have made you go read to her. I wanted you to see something about her. I wanted you to see what real courage is instead of getting the idea that courage is a man with a gun in his hand. It's when you know you're licked before you begin, but you begin anyway and you see it through no matter what. You rarely win, but sometimes you do. Mrs. DeBose won, all 98 pounds of her. According to her views, she died beholden to nothing and nobody. She was the bravest person I ever knew. Isn't that just like so powerful and so touching? And the fact that it didn't matter that they totally disagreed. They had very different views on like everything, but he could recognize the incredible virtues within this woman. And he wanted to hold her up as somebody who had great courage and to have his son learn from her. How different is that from what we see every day? Like if somebody has different views from us, they are just a bad person. There's nothing good about them. Do you know what I'm saying? We can't have a conversation with them. We can't be civil with them. We certainly can. But I'm just saying, I feel like that's sort of like the general air that we live in right now. Somebody thinks differently than you. They're just a bad person. And he's going, yeah. No, like she had incredible virtue. She was the most courageous person that I knew. And I wanted you to be able to see that.
Atticus treats everybody with respect and like there's good in everybody. And I mean, what an awesome man.
Yeah.
That just reminds me, like this week I saw a clip of a news program and this lady was talking about one group of political views. And she was like, so what are we going to do about all the crazies? She was referring to a whole political party.
Yeah.
Like, how can we get to the point where when people disagree with us or they don't do things the way that we think that they should, that we can still be respectful? And how do we get
that we can still be respectful and realize like we can't just label someone as something and that is their entire personality. That's their entire demeanor. That's everything that they think. And we have just decided every way that they think. And we've decided every action that they're ever going to take. Like, that's crazy. That's what's crazy.
And Atticus isn't like that.
Not at all. So
the other thing I loved about this chapter was there were several words in here that were like, what? Okay, Guppernong.
Oh, yeah.
What the heck? Maybe it's a plant because it's a Guppernong arbor. Okay. Then you probably know what these words mean, but philippic. We were followed up the sidewalk by a philippic on our family's moral degeneration. Do you know what that means?
No. Mm-mm.
I
We
meant
should
to
look it
look
up
these
real
up.
quick.
No, I meant to look these up and I failed. But like this chapter, like I haven't found this in this book. And then this chapter was full of words. And I was like, what even is that? Okay, philippic is a bitter attack or a denunciation, especially a verbal one. That makes sense.
Okay.
Because people were like yelling at them from the, like
Yeah.
when they would go into the streets, they would yell horrible things at them.
Yeah.
And then, do you know what an umbrage is? Or
Umbrage.
umbrage, there we go.
Yeah. So the thing about that is that's a, you, are you familiar with Harry Potter?
Yeah, a little bit.
Like, so Professor Umbridge.
Uh-huh.
J.K. Rowling names all of her characters for a reason. They all have a meaning behind their name. It just, so let's see. Umbrage, the specific definition is offense or annoyance.
So annoying.
So if somebody takes umbrage at your remarks, it means that they take offense by at your remarks, or they're annoyed at your remarks, which is interesting because Professor Umbridge takes offense to everything, and she herself is very offensive, and she gets annoyed at everybody, right? Like especially Harry and his friends, and she finds the smallest things to be annoyed at. And so, yes, that's what it means to take umbrage to something, is to just be annoyed by it and
Probably need
offended
to
by it.
read Harry Potter from the beginning. I read like the first two, I think, and I probably need to go back and read them and then keep reading. That sounds interesting. Then the
Yeah.
last word was palliation. She was a less than satisfactory source of palliation. This is, he's
Wow.
talking about Calpurnia, but then it says, but she did give Jem a hot biscuit and butter. Palliation. Let's see. Easing the severity of a pain or a disease. So she was trying to make him feel better.
Interesting.
I just thought that was interesting that this
Cool.
whole
Yeah.
chapter had like all these words. And I was
Lots
like,
of cool words.
what does it
The
even
one that
mean?
I have is not so large or maybe refined, but I just, it made me think of my grandma because Atticus uses the word druthers a few times. He's like, if I had my druthers. So my grandma, she will be 97 in April. So she was, yeah, she was born in 1927. But that is, that's a word that she often uses. She's like, well, if I had my druthers, which just means if I had the things that I would rather have,
I had my
I'd,
way.
yeah, if I had my way, if I had, I'd rather do this than that. I'd rather not. I'd rather. So they just say, if I had my druthers.
I've heard it, but I don't know anybody that said it
Okay. Yeah.
regularly. Chapter two. So this is the beginning of part two. Okay, so now Jem is 12 and he's super irritated with Scout hanging around him so much. And he also wants her to start acting more like a girl. Like a lot of people around her, they want her to act like a girl. This is upsetting to Scout, but she decides it's okay. I'm looking forward to Dill coming this summer, so it's fine if he doesn't want to hang out with me anymore. But Dill does not come this year. So he sends them a letter saying that he has this new father who has all these great things planned for him to do this summer. And so he's going to stay with his family in Meridian. So we assume that his mother got remarried to this guy.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
And then that's one problem is that Dill's not coming. But then also the state legislature is called into session and Atticus has to go to the state capitol every day for 2 weeks. So he's gone a bunch, which must mean that he's gone on Sunday. So every day must
Yeah.
mean every day. So Calpurnia decides one Sunday that she's going to take the kids to her church. Now, Maycomb's Black Church is in an old building called First Purchase because it was bought with the first earnings of freed slaves. It's kind of cool. There's one woman there that is not very happy about Calpurnia bringing white children to their church, but everybody else pretty much seems to be welcoming. The Reverend welcomes them and says, everybody, do they say that everybody knows of her father or they know her father, their father?
I thought this just said everybody knew her father.
So he's a friend to everybody. That's a good goal in life, to not make any, well, I guess he is making enemies, but to be a friend to everybody. So I also loved that the congregation doesn't have money for hymn books. First notice, there's no hymn books there.
Yeah.
Why don't you have any hymn books, you know? And then they notice that Zebo, who is Calpurnia's oldest son, he like reads them a line from the only hymn book they have there. And then the congregation like sings it back to him. Was it called lining? Lining?
Yeah.
Okay. I was looking for the word and I couldn't find it in there, but I knew it. I thought that's what it was called. So they ask about it. They're like, well, why don't you have any hymnals? And they can't afford them. And nobody can really read. Like very few people can read there. So Calpurnia can. Obviously her son can because she probably taught him, but most of them can't. So this is their way of singing. And the kids are kind of just amazed by it. They're like looking around like, okay.
Yeah.
But they must like, they, it seems like they enjoy going to her church. So then the Reverend asks, I loved what he, how he asked. He asks for donations for Helen, who is Tom Robinson's wife. And she can't find work because of her husband being accused of rape. So nobody wants to hire her. But I love how he's like, the Reverend's like, well, so we're going to lock the doors until until we have enough money for her. Nobody's leaving until there's enough money in the
I
collection.
know. I love it. That was so funny. I was like, all right, different way.
And the kids are like, well, we have money in our, like, in our pockets. And Calpurnia is like, no, you're not giving them your money. But yeah, he's like, if everybody in the room donates, was it? I can't remember if it was a penny or a nickel, quarter,
I
something
think
like that.
another dime, because they had initially sent around, or everybody had initially donated. And then after that, he's like, hey, we don't have $10. We're not leaving until we got to shuts the door. So Jem and Scout actually do end up giving their own little dimes, because Cal had given them hers to be like, you don't need to use yours. So, but they were like, look, we have some, so we'll add that. So he was like, if everybody gives another dime, and he called people specifically out. He's like, you didn't come up the walk last time. You need to come donate.
Can you imagine going to a church where they're like, okay, you didn't donate this year or
Yeah.
this or today or
Yeah.
whatever. And
Just
like,
out in front of everybody.
yeah. And like the idea of passing a collection plate around, embarrassing. You would feel pressure to donate.
And maybe that's the entire purpose behind it, is to sort of have that.
I just loved it. We're locking the doors. Nobody's leaving until we have enough money for Helen. So good luck. Okay. So after the service, then that's when Scout learns that Tom Robinson had been accused by Bob Ewell. She can't understand why anybody would believe them. She's like, nobody believes anything they say. Why is this even an issue? Well, because they'll believe him over a black man.
Right.
So as they come home from church then that day, they see a nice little surprise waiting for them on the porch. Aunt Alexandra, that they didn't know was coming, and she's sitting there like she belongs there.
The other thing about the preacher, though, is that not only would he call people out if they hadn't donated, he would like talk about people's shortcomings from the pulpit. So and so is having an issue with this right now. And this lady, you know, what did he say exactly?
That's another church I wouldn't want to go to.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
They already know enough about us, church.
Jim Hardy had been absent from church for 5 Sundays and he wasn't sick. Constance Jackson had better watch her way. She was in grave danger for quarreling with her neighbors. Yeah, so he doesn't have a problem just calling people out right there from the pulpit. Like, can you imagine just how mortified that would be? Oh my gosh. But people keep coming back. They seem to like this guy.
It's the only black church in town. I don't know where they have to go.
That's
You
true.
don't
That's true.
Probably didn't go any better.
So chapter 13, we get into this with Aunt Alexandra, and she's come because, according to her, she and Atticus have talked and they've decided that Scout needs a woman in her life to teach her things. And I love Scout's response in her mind, the things she wishes she could say out loud. She's like, I could have made several answers to this. Cal's a girl. It would be many years before I would be interested in boys. I would never be interested in clothes, because Aunt Alexandra's like, you know, you're almost to the time we're going to be interested in clothes and boys, and you need a girl around to help you with those things. She's like, not you. And again, she says, Uncle Jimmy present or Uncle Jimmy absent made not much difference. He never said anything. It's just kind of funny. He's just sort of this character. And it's funny too, because she talks about how whenever Aunt Alexandra asks her, like, what do you do all day and who are your friends and stuff, she just kind of gives like one or two word answers. And so Aunt Alexandra actually thinks that Scout is a very sluggish, sort of boring girl. And we all know very differently, but she doesn't feel like she wants to talk to Aunt Alexandra or tell her anything about what she's probably because she knows she's going to be critiqued and sort of slammed for anything that she says, because all the things that she loves are the things that Aunt Alexandra totally disapproves of. So we kind of get sort of this rundown of things that Alexandra does while she's there. Like, she kind of jumps right into the society and starts these different things. We also get a little bit of history of the Finch family. It's interesting too, because she's somebody who's very, she's all about sort of bloodlines and heredity and things like this. She would be somebody who would fit very well into, the nobility in any European country, where they really believe that if you are a lord, a lady, a king, a queen, a princess, you really are just better than everybody else because of your blood. No, I was born higher than you, so I am actually better than you. And so this is sort of the exact same attitude that she has. Something Scout says, she says, "I never understood her preoccupation with heredity. Somewhere I had received the impression that fine folks were people who did the best they could with the sense they had. But Aunt Alexandra was of the opinion, obliquely expressed, that the longer a family had been squatting on one patch of land, the finer it was." So if they've lived in a place for a really long time, they must be fine folks. That's pretty low standard. And Jem and Scout can kind of immediately call out the BS on that, because they're like, well, by that logic, the Yules are fine folks. And everybody knows that they're not. It also talks about how Maycomb sort of came to be. And it talks about how, like, it was ignored during the Civil War, but Reconstruction rule and economic ruin forced the town to grow, and it grew inward because the same families were like intermarrying to the point that people started to look very similar. I thought that was really funny. Like, you walk through town, you're like, oh, everybody kind of looks alike. Family, lots of similar family genes happening here. It says that there was a caste system in Maycomb, but to my mind, it worked this way. The older citizens, the present generation of people who had lived side by side for years and years, were utterly predictable to one another. They took for granted attitudes, character shadings, even gestures, as having been repeated in each generation and refined by time. So they had like sort of these little phrases for each family, like, no Crawford minds his own business. Every third Merriweather is morbid. The truth is not in the Delafields. All the Bufords walk like that. It's just kind of funny. It's like they almost all know each other too well, honestly.
They've been generations and generations they've been together.
Yeah. And they all know each other really well, but Jem and Scout don't necessarily know how everybody is tied to them. And so Alexandra is like, well, this is everything because this makes us important. And so she's mortified that they don't know who Cousin Lily is or whatever. And so she sends Atticus into their room one night to be like, he says, your aunt has asked me to try and impress upon you and you guys that you are not from run-of-the-mill people. You are the product of several generations' gentle breeding. You should try to live up to your name, says it to Scout and Jem. You must try to behave like the little lady and gentleman that you are. Scout and Jem are just kind of horrified. They're like, what is coming from our father's mouth? And it probably makes them like really dislike their aunt even more, because they know this is all coming directly from her. But they're also going, why is our father doing this? He's like one of the strongest and best men, and yet he's sort of like caving to what she says. So Scout like breaks down because I think she's really like, where is my father? And feeling very insecure and unsafe because the man that she knows and loves is like not behaving as himself. So they kind of have this little back and forth. It's like he comes to himself. He puts his hand on the back of her head and he says, don't you worry about anything. It's not time to worry. And she's like, do you really want us to do all that? I can't remember everything finches are supposed to do. And he's just like, I don't want you to remember it. Forget it. There it is. I don't know. That chapter was kind of funny, but
It makes you wonder why, like, why did he go through the effort of going in and telling him all that when he didn't like believe any of it? And why is he trying to pacify Aunt Alexandra? It's just funny. He's like, don't remember it, just forget it. I
yeah.
love that part.
But I think like I kind of get it. It's like her personality is very strong, very bossy, and he is a wonderful parent, and it's like you said, it's like he has this way that he's decided he's going to parent, and he's sticking with it. But that doesn't mean that he never questions it, you know? And especially when you get this very bossy woman, that he's probably like, well, maybe she is right. So it may take, and maybe I'm like way off here, but it may take these moments when he's in talking to his kids, and then he's suddenly like, no, actually, this is ridiculous. Why do I care about this at all?
He probably hurt himself and he's like, never mind.
Yeah. That's kind of what I wonder. Like, I could see that.
The part that I loved at the beginning of the chapter was when she's there and Atticus says to the kids, how'd you like for her to come live with us? And Scout, she says, I said I would like it very much, which was a lie. But one must lie under certain circumstances and at all times when one can't do anything about them.
Yeah.
So cute. Like, often do we just say, yeah, everything's great. Yeah, we want you to stay.
Yeah, and I think that's a valid point that sometimes we lie because there's nothing we can actually do about it anyway. So what's the point in like starting something?
Yeah, that's true. And it's kind of like having a bad attitude about something when you can't change it. So it's like,
yeah,
well, you're just upsetting yourself because you
you're
want
ju- yeah, you're yeah. just upsetting yourself and draining your own energy. So it's like, okay, whatever.
I loved the end too, the very last part where she talks earlier about cousin Joshua, who cost the family $500.
Oh, yeah.
And after he tells him to forget it, he went to the door and out of the room, shutting the door behind him. He nearly slammed it, but caught himself at the last minute and closed it softly. As Jem and I stared, the door opened again, and Atticus peered around. His eyebrows were raised. His glasses had slipped. Get more like cousin Joshua every day, don't I? Do you think I'll end up costing the family $500? He's just like, oh, I just love Atticus.
Yeah.
Told you that my sister wanted to name a little baby boy Atticus, and now you totally get it now. Totally.
Yeah, seriously.
Oh,
and you're like, that's kind of a big name for a baby, but such a great name after just such a great character.
yes.
So it works.
The last chapter of today is chapter 14, and I loved this too. Because Atticus is defending Tom Robinson in the rape trial, then Jem and Scout are like constantly noticing people whispering about them, looking at them whenever they go to town. One day, Scout asks Atticus what rape is. And he says, rape is carnal knowledge of a female by force without consent. All right.
Very dry denotation. I mean, it is the definition.
But
There
Scout
you go.
Says, okay.
Yeah.
But Scout's reaction is, if that's all, then why did Calpurnia dry me up when I asked her? Like, doesn't make any sense. And it's funny because his explanation to his brother Jack was like, well, you just got to tell him what it is. But then in this situation, he's not going to tell her what it is. He's just like, comes up with this clinical.
Yeah, very clinical response.
So then it comes out at this time that they had gone to church with Calpurnia when he was gone. And Atticus kind of seems amused by the story. Like, he's kind of enjoying it. And Aunt Alexandra is just like staring at them like, what? So Scout says, you know what? Calpurnia said I could come back with her and we could go to her house. And how about next Sunday? I want to do it next Sunday. And Alexandra says, you may not. And then Scout realizes who had just said this. And the book says, I wheeled around, startled, then turned back to Atticus in time to catch his swift glance at her. But it was too late. She said, I didn't ask you. Oh, when I was a kid, if I would have said something like that or like talked back to another adult, I would have gotten in so much trouble.
Yeah, totally.
And then it says, for a big man, Atticus could get up and down from a chair faster than anyone I ever knew. He was on his feet. Apologize to your aunt, he said. She apologizes. Atticus tells her that she's going to do what her aunt says as long as her aunt is there. He's like, you listen to me, you listen to Calpurnia. You're going to listen to Aunt Alexandra as long as she's here. So Scout decides that to save her dignity, she needs to go to the bathroom for a while, like go spend some time in there and be in there long enough that they actually believe that she had to go. When she comes out, she's hiding in the hall. She sounds like she's always hiding in the hall, listening. And she's listening to a, quote, fierce discussion going on in the living room. And this was my favorite quote of the chapter. Through the door, I could see Jem on the sofa with a football magazine in front of his face, his head turning as if its pages contained a live tennis match. He's like,
I know, that was so good.
Yes. Aunt Alexandra is then trying to convince Atticus to get rid of Calpurnia, which at first Scout is afraid that they're talking about her, but then she's like, oh good, they're just talking about Calpurnia, not me. But you know, Atticus says, I need her now more than I ever did. The kids love her. She's probably been harder on them than their own mother would have been. We need her here. At this point, the kids go to Jem's room and Jem tells Scout, like, not to keep antagonizing Aunt Alexandra. He's probably like, to stop. Like, you're just making things difficult here.
Yeah.
But he also explains to her that their dad is just super worried about this Tom Robinson case. And she doesn't understand why he'd be worried about it. Like, you know, in a kid's mind, it's like things come and go and you don't worry about things forever. But like as an adult, you'll stew on things and like they fester and you worry. This does not make her happy that he is like kind of telling her what to do. And so she attacks him. And what goes from like punches turns into a brawl. And then Atticus comes in to break it up and he kind of sends them to bed. Scout goes to her room and she's standing by her bed and she feels something kind of funny under the bed that she thinks is like a snake. So she yells to Jem. Jem comes in the room and she's like, what does a snake feel like? I think there's a snake under my bed. But they realize it's not a snake. It's a person. So Dill jumps out. He says he's hungry. He asks for something to eat. She runs and gets him something to eat. And we find out that he's there because he'd ran away from home in Meridian. He'd like taken his mom's money and jumped on a train and come out there. And then he walked like several miles to their house. But we find out that he's out there because his mother and his new father just aren't paying attention to him anymore. They just don't have time for him. They don't want him around. They kind of, don't they ask him like, well, is he beating you? And he's like, no. It's just.
Yeah. And that made me really sad. It's like, yeah, there's no abuse, but there's also just no love at all. It's very apparent to him that they could care less whether he's around or not. Even though they'll be like, oh, good night, we love you, or goodbye, we love you. But he knows that he's not feeling that at all.
Yeah.
It's not really true because it's evident that they would rather him not be there.
I love it too that like the kids trust their dad enough to
love
tell
that
him.
Too. Yeah.
And he does. He does the right thing. He's like, okay, well, we need to call Aunt Rachel and tell her that he's here, but he can stay the night and like, we better get him some food and he's here. So
yeah,
I'm excited to see what's going to happen. Dill is there and so good. So good.
They do. They feel 100% safe with Atticus all the time to where in this situation, they're like, what is the first thing that we need to do? Go tell our dad, you know?
And they trust him. I don't know if that's a good stopping point, but it's how it worked out with the pages.
I think it is because now we've got Dill here and it's good. Now we're going to have some more adventures because now summer can really start. Cause I think they were pretty disappointed that he wasn't going to be there.
And then I thought it was funny too, that he like, I didn't say this, but he's supposed to sleep with Jem and then he goes and he's like, oh, I want to sleep with you. They're just really close.
Yeah.
So next week we'll do chapters 15 through 21. Our third installment. And then we've got one more after that.
Okay.
I feel like so much has happened in this book. And
but we haven't even gotten into the trial yet.
Oh.
So
I'm excited.
There's a lot more. Lots of good stuff.
So what are you reading?
Okay. The book that I wanted to share, it's really good. And it's part of history that I have not known much about. So it's called The Night Diary. And it's another one that I'm reading aloud to my kids. It's called The Night Diary by Veera Hiranandani. Basically, it's 1947. And it's when India, it's just been freed from British rule. And so you think, oh, yay, this is great. And for the most part, that is good. But here's the thing is that while the British were there, the Hindus, the Muslims, the Sikhs, they were all living together quite peacefully. The British leave, and then there's all these politicians who are like, no, the Muslims need their own place. The Hindus and Sikhs should go someplace else. And so that's when India was broken up into, that's when Pakistan became a country. So they drew this line and divided India into India and Pakistan. I didn't know that. And so this little girl, her name is Nisha, her parents were very unusual because, yes, like Muslims and Hindus lived together and they were quite friendly and everything, but you didn't intermarry. And her mother was actually a Muslim and her father was a Hindu. And her mother died when she was just a baby. So now they're just considered Hindu. So they're experiencing quite a lot of unrest and they're kind of being told to leave. There's children throwing rocks at them because Hindus and Muslims like dress differently. Their names are different. So they can tell you know, who is what by, you know, there's these little telltale signs. So they're going to have to leave because the area they live in is now Pakistan. So you're going to need to leave and get to India. And it's very dangerous, very treacherous. Lots of people are killed trying to cross the border. So, and this is an interesting book because it's, I think they call it epistolic, because it's a book written in letters. So it's, and it's letters to her mom. So it's like she's keeping a diary, but she's writing these letters as if she's writing the diary in the form of letters to her mom, is what I should say.
Yeah.
So she's like talking to her mom. It's really, there's lots of really sweet stuff, and it's good. Lots of good history.
I'm so impressed with how much you guys learned from books.
My gosh. It's just so wonderful how many books there are out there that teach you so much.
How long do you read each day?
It depends on the day and kind of the book too. Like if it's something that's very wordy and very heavy, I might not read as much. This one, I'm just like, we're reading this many pages each day. If they want to read more, we can read more, but that's kind of what we're doing. So
I finished The Orphan Keeper, which I absolutely loved, by Cameron Wright. Loved it. And then this next book I'm reading, I absolutely loved too, is called The Unmaking of June Farrow by Adrienne Young. I heard about it on Instagram and I was like, somebody said, like, if you start this book, you won't be able to put it down. And I was like, okay, I need a book like that. Oh, so good. It's about this family line of women that, like, they kind of have a curse. And, like, it's basically like they go insane.
Oh, wow.
They kind of, like, lose their minds towards the end of their life, right? Well, what you find out is that these women have the ability to time travel. And so, like, pretty soon in their life, they'll start seeing doors appearing. And then eventually they will go through the door and they end up like in a different time. And so every time they do it, they kind of lose their minds more. And they're allowed to time travel 3 times.
So before they go just completely insane, or?
Then the doors stop appearing.
Oh.
And they're pretty insane by then. Yeah. And so
interesting.
It's starts out with this lady in 2023. She is being raised by her grandma because her mother had, like, basically disappeared, which she doesn't know. And, like, every time she asks her grandma about it, her grandma's like, I'm not going to tell you. And anyways, so her grandma dies, and her grandma's, like, lifelong friend, she had been keeping it a secret that she'd started to go crazy. And then she tells her friend, and her grandma's friend, and her grandma's friend's like, you need to go through the door. And so it's so good. So she travels back to 1951. And it's so good.
That sounds really cool.
I loved every second of it. I think I listened to it in one day.
Oh, awesome.
So good. So if you don't mind time travel, and the time travel gets a little bit heavy for me, like, I don't totally understand it sometimes. They'll explain, you know, the author will, like, explain their version of time travel, and you're like, huh?
Sure. But yeah.
Just let that go.
It's how it makes sense in their head or something.
Yeah. Women can't go to a time when they already exist.
Sure.
Right? Like, they can't.
Yeah.
But then the girl, and basically the woman in 2023 did something as a future her in 1946. So when she travels to 1951, like, everybody's mad at her and they all recognize her and they're like, you're back. But she had done something that they couldn't forgive her for. And then basically she was just trying to stop this from happening because she didn't want this to keep going with the generations. Right.
Yeah.
So she was trying to stop it. So interesting. Good.
Cool.
This might be like one of my favorite books of the year.
Wow. Awesome.
And it's January, but
good way to start the year.
Awesome. Right.
And okay. Where did you find that book?
I follow this lady on Instagram, and she was doing a book club about it, like, at the end of the month. She just does a monthly book club, and she usually has, like, the author on. Megan's Book Club.
Okay.
And it's spelled Meagan, and she lives in Colorado, I think, but that's where I heard about it. She said it was, like, excellent. And I was like, okay, I need something that is, like, you can't put it down. When I'm when I'm listening to something on the road and stuff, I need something just like that. So
totally. That makes good sense. And kind of a side note, like when you told me about The Orphan Keeper, I was like, first of all, I totally have heard of that. You said it was by Cameron Wright. And I was like, I know I've read a book by Cameron Wright, but I couldn't remember what it was. And then I finally remembered. And it's The Rent Collector. Do you remember that book? You read that one.
I think
So
so.
good. So I know that. So anyway, I was like, well, I know that I like that author. I need to go find The Orphan Keeper. I was invited to write a blog post for my friend's website. And in it, I just talk about reading good books to my children and a little bit about our podcast. And so, and she has a beautiful website. She has a beautiful Etsy shop, and it's The Refined Schoolhouse. And her name is Talia. So I'd say go check that out. We'll put the link for that in our show notes for this one and for this podcast. But the blog will have been posted a couple of weeks previous to this. But I would think you should be able to easily find it because the link that I'll share will take you directly to it. So, but check out all of her other stuff too. She has some nice things.
That's amazing, though. I can't wait tomorrow to see that. So, and you wrote it, right? The article.
Yeah.
We're so happy you joined us for this episode. We hope you will join us next week as we discuss To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee, chapters 15 through 21. If you have suggestions for books we should read and discuss, please email us at thebestbookspodcast@gmail.com. We would love it if you would leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts and share our podcast with your friends. We want to inspire and encourage as many people as we can to read out of the best books.
As Thoreau says, read the best books first, or you may not have a chance to read them at all. See you next week.